You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Evers has asked the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, to do a preliminary damage estimate for a severe winter storm and lakeshore flooding that struck the southeastern part of our state earlier this month. It's the first step in determining whether Wisconsin will request a federal disaster declaration. The governor said earlier this week that that storm, combined with already high water on Lake Michigan, caused significant damage in Racine, Kenosha, and Milwaukee counties. Do you live along Lake Michigan? Have you had flooding from storms? How much damage are you dealing with? Do you live near a lake? Is that causing flooding issues? We're at 800-642-1234. Christina Leffering is a reporter with the Journal Times newspaper in Racine. Christina, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start in Racine County. What kind of damage are you seeing there?
Well, the most significant damage was along Pershing Park. That's a strip of park that's right along the lake, and it also runs up to our boat launch. And that area got hit really hard by the waves on that Saturday. A lot of infrastructure issues with that. Also, like with like breakwater and the drainage systems, there was a drainage pipe that was dislodged from its connecting pipe. And this is like a very large, you know, metal pipe that was just kind of flung into the air. The DPW commissioner just said it was thrown around like a soda can. So,
wow,
really, really strong waves that day. And also along Zoo Beach and North Beach, those are kind of, which makes sense, those are our largest stretches of lakefront public park area. They saw a lot of debris. There was a long cleanup period. And
how have homeowners been affected?
In Racine County, we haven't seen as much of that. That the most brutal kind of effects of that we've seen a little further south to us in Kenosha, like Pleasant Prairie. I'm assuming it would probably also be an issue in Summers, where that house was falling into the lake earlier this last year. So, but Racine County, we haven't seen as much.
What do we know about how this storm is going to play out with FEMA? Will Wisconsin get assistance? What do we know there?
Well, at this point, it appears that city officials plan to meet with FEMA on Tuesday. And they're going to kind of evaluate the damage and go from there.
And when you say city officials, which city are we talking about here?
City of Racine. So in Racine County, the majority of the damage, which was estimated at 6.45 million, 6.424 million of that was in the city of Racine. So, at least in Racine County, it seems to have been mostly concentrated in our area.
We're talking with Christina Leffering. She's a reporter with the Journal Times newspaper in Racine, looking at flood damage in several counties, Racine, Kenosha, and Milwaukee, and how communities are handling it, clearing up. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Are you concerned about higher lake levels in Lake Michigan? What should the state be doing to mitigate that? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Christina, what kind of damage are you seeing in Milwaukee County?
I haven't done any reporting in Milwaukee County, so I can't really.
You've been really focused on Racine. So with record high water levels, what is the impact with erosion?
Well, what's interesting about this incident is that it's kind of an exacerbation of the erosion that we're already seeing on the lake. I mean, water levels were really low for a long time, so I think that erosion kind of fell off of a lot of people's radar. And then when the water levels rose up again, now we've been seeing I mean, I mentioned that house in Summers. That got a lot of coverage, that it was an abandoned property that was falling into the lake. And so that has kind of prompted a lot of people, scientists, officials, residents, to kind of take a look at our shoreline. And, I mean, shorelines are always changing, whether water's high or low. But with high waters, it does raise some concerns, particularly along bluffs, and particularly among residents who are more or less on their own. They don't, they are at this point solely responsible for maintaining their shoreline.
Have you seen any projects in the works to stop some of this or prevent some of this erosion?
There's definitely been some projects, particularly with green infrastructure. So using kind of natural infrastructure that mimics things like dunes and wetlands, basically what was already in place before people came along and developed the area, to kind of mitigate the effects of erosion. A good example of that is Sam Myers Park here in Racine. It's received a lot of recognition for its use of kind of green infrastructure, but unfortunately that that park was also damaged in this storm.
So all the progress they had made there with that green infrastructure there has been washed away.
Well, I don't know if we could say all, but it has definitely been significantly damaged.
What happens if there's another big storm?
That's a really good question, because, I mean, this isn't like a tornado where it lands and then you clean up and fix everything and then life goes on. I mean, we are still going to be living with high lake waters. And because we've had an abnormally warm winter, we don't have that ice buffer between the waves and the shoreline. So, and this is a windy place. So it's not unreasonable to believe that this could happen again.
What about the drainage pipes that were floating about? Have those been fixed?
I don't know about the progress on any of those particular items.
Yeah.
I know that crews had to spend a lot of time cleaning up Pershing Park Drive. It's a road that kind of goes along through Pershing Park, but that road had to be closed, and there was all kinds of rubble from the rocks that were used to reinforce the shoreline along Pershing Park. But as far as any particular items, I don't know about their status. I assume that they would have moved the pipe by now. It's been a few weeks. So,
and is there a timeline for any federal assistance if it does come at all?
That is
yet to be determined.
Yet to be determined, yeah.
Well, Christina, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Christina Leffering is a reporter with the Journal Times newspaper in Racine, talking about damage there from a recent storm. Coming up, search and rescue missions are vital work, painstaking work, but regulation and oversight are lacking in many states. Sometimes there's no regulation of this, and it's largely volunteer-led. We'll learn more about this work and what it takes. That's in a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're going to talk athletes and politics. Athletes realize that stepping into the activist role often means putting their career at risk. But think of all those who've done it, from the raised fists of John Carlos and Tommy Smith in 1968 to contemporary athletes like Colin Kaepernick taking a knee during the national anthems. How do you feel about athletes sharing their political views? Will you watch for activism on Super Bowl Sunday? Join in right now, 800-642-1234. But first, search and rescue operations are crucial when someone goes missing. Often these operations are led entirely by volunteers. They do vital work searching for evidence of a missing person and at times recovering human remains. But the training for volunteers and the rules they operate under vary a lot from state to state. Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisConText, and he's been reporting on this, and he talked with WPR host Keely Baltina.
Who makes up these search and rescue teams, and what are they deployed to do?
Yeah, there are a few counties in the state that have in-house professionalized search and rescue teams, but only a few of them. The vast majority of communities in the state, the search and rescue teams are volunteer-based. So it's volunteer organizers and volunteers who are out doing the search and rescues.
And what are they often searching for?
Anything from a missing person, whether it's someone who got lost in the woods, like a hiker or a camper, or sometimes a senior citizen, maybe with dementia or something, might wander away from a group home or something like that. But they also will search for possible human remains, dead bodies, if there's an idea that there might be one perhaps in like a lake or the woods or something like that.
So there's quite a range. We saw this, I think, most high profile in, recently with the kidnapping of Jamie Kloss, and when people came out in full force to try to search for her. Where did we see the volunteers playing into that investigation?
Yeah, volunteers participated in that investigation in a couple ways. First, there was the pretty public search in the days after Jamie Kloss's disappearance, where the sheriff's department asked for 100 volunteers or so to help scour the local fields and ditches, collect potential evidence. That's a pretty typical response to a missing person case like that. That's pretty high profile. Less public was a request from the sheriff's department for volunteer search and rescue canine handlers. And several canine handlers did answer that call from neighboring counties, and they participated in a little bit quieter way, searching the vicinity around the Kloss home for potential evidence with the use of these scent tracking dogs that are really, really useful. And they did so under the guidance of law enforcement.
And I think I often assume that we're looking for people, but hitting on the fact that they're also looking for any shred of evidence that they can find is really key for these volunteers.
Totally. Yep.
You spoke with some of them. What did they have to say about why they do this? Because they don't get paid.
Not only do they not get paid, but they spend an awful lot of money sometimes on training, particularly for volunteer canine handlers. They have to spend thousands of dollars on training, hundreds of hours training their dogs and themselves. But really, it's a passion of a lot of these volunteers. It's kind of like a hobby turned passion. A lot of people get into it because they're interested in wilderness survival or tracking techniques or wilderness navigation, what have you, and then get kind of sucked into the world of search and rescue.
And realize that they can make a difference, that they can help.
Exactly. They can provide a public service.
Sounds like different states have different levels of regulation when it comes to these volunteer search and rescue teams. We've got a couple of ends of the spectrum and then some folks in the middle there. Let's start with California, which regulates search and rescue operations pretty heavily.
They do, which I think a lot of people may not be surprised about that. California has a lot of regulations around a whole bunch of things,
right,
including search and rescue. And part of the reason for that in California is because search and rescue volunteers are dealing often with much more intense terrain than we find here in the Midwest, really mountainous and remote regions. So there's more requirements around training for search and rescue volunteers, and there are more protections for those volunteers, financial protections in the case that they get injured or die on a search.
Unsurprisingly, I think, if we assume that California fits into our understanding that it's more highly regulated, we see a lot less regulation in a place like Texas.
Yes. Again, kind of living up to stereotypes. In Texas. And so I got this information from the executive director of a national association for search and rescue volunteers. And he's actually based in Texas, so he has some local insight. In Texas, they do live up to their kind of like Wild West reputation. He said there's really no regulation. Search and rescue teams don't have to follow any particular training. They don't have to be affiliated with a sheriff's department, as they do in many states. They can ask for money. He said that this leads to kind of like competing teams in local areas. He said there are several competing teams in the Houston area, and sometimes they'll work just directly with families rather than the sheriff's department, so it can be really unorganized, and sometimes they'll then demand money.
Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisContext, and we're talking about his latest two pieces that look at search and rescue operations. Okay, now we know where Texas stands. We know where California stands. Where does Wisconsin land?
Wisconsin is pretty much in the middle, like a lot of states. So there are a few rules around volunteer search and rescue teams. They do have to be affiliated with the sheriff's department. There is protocol for how sheriffs can activate search and rescue team. Or ask for neighboring counties to provide their services through mutual aid. And also search and rescue. There's no specific training that's required by the state, but search and rescue teams do require, in Wisconsin, do require their own trainings, which are really quite rigorous.
So there's an amount of self-policing that happens within these volunteer organizations or these groups of people that may want to respond when they're asked.
Correct. But in Wisconsin, there aren't the financial protections for search and rescue volunteers as there are in California.
So there's a circumstance where you're dealing in dangerous circumstances or it's night or you trip and fall or you get hurt. You're responsible for that because you're volunteering.
Yeah, you have to hope that your own health insurance will cover that. There's no entitlement to workers' compensation or death benefits for search and rescue volunteers, which is different from other kind of emergency response volunteers in the state. So volunteer firefighters, EMTs are entitled to those workers' comp and death benefits.
Mm, but not search and rescue.
Right.
Where in the state have we really professionalized or standardized those search and rescue operations?
It really just depends on who is – maybe there's a really passionate organizer in some area, and that really is the case with the folks I spoke to. Sawyer County in northern Wisconsin really has a really quite professionalized crew of over 30 volunteers at any given time. And part of that is just because of the people up there who have been involved in search and rescue for decades, including county staff there who work on emergency management issues. And there are other groups like that around the state that are really quite professionalized. A lot of times they're also affiliated with canine tracking capabilities. They just have to be a little bit more trained. And a lot of those kind of are on the state lines. So there's a group that does searches in Wisconsin, Minnesota, kind of in western Wisconsin, and then another group near the border with Illinois and another group near the border with the UP.
Do we know what role state agencies play in search and rescue?
Really, search and rescue is a largely local endeavor. The state will get involved, like Wisconsin Emergency Management, will get involved if there's a request for aerial support. Usually that aerial support is more for situational awareness to help provide the search and rescue volunteers on the ground with information that they might not be able to glean from being on the ground. But that's largely where the state comes in.
Do we know how successful search and rescue operations in Wisconsin are?
We don't, which is another issue that the gentleman I spoke to from the national organization said. It's quite an issue when there's no tracking or recording mechanism across the state. So you don't know how successful the searches are. You don't know if they're are maybe issues that could be addressed from systemic issues related to is there a certain demographic or a certain area where people go missing or what have you. There are all sorts of potentially important and useful information that the state is just not gathering. And that does occur in some places like California.
Okay. So, but potentially an area that Wisconsin could improve.
Yes, exactly.
Will, this has been really enlightening. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
And that was Will Cushman, the associate editor of WisConText, who spoke earlier this week with WPR host Keely Baltina. Find more of Will's reporting. It is at wiscontext.org. Coming up, professional athletes who take up social justice issues, they may put their careers in jeopardy for taking a stance. Ahead of the Super Bowl, do you think sports leagues should censor athletes or coaches or team managers? Or should they be allowed to say what they want? Phone lines are open, 800-642-1234. Let's talk about the politics of sports and hear your thoughts right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And just a side note here on our programming, the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump resumes at noon, with the trial moving to a period of debate. And you can hear live NPR coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio's News and Classical Network and online at WPR.org. Here in the Ideas Network, we'll keep you up to date and invite you into the conversation for analysis. Right now, we're exploring the politics of sports. Pro athletes are in the spotlight, and so when they take on social justice issues, it gets attention. One example is 1968. U.S. Olympians Tommy Smith and John Carlos, who'd won gold and bronze, they raised black glove fists during the medal ceremony at the Summer Games there in Mexico City. It became one of the most iconic sports images of the 20th century, a black power salute that rocked the world. Here's Tommy Smith reflecting on it last year on CBS News.
People could not understand. It was not about the flag. It was a chance to heighten the idea that we must eradicate stupidity called racism.
How do you feel about athletes sharing their views? Should they be allowed to express themselves or just focus on the sport? What will you be watching for in the Super Bowl? We're at 800-642-1234. Jason Quito Lopez is a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Communication Arts at UW-Madison, where he teaches sports media and media ethics. Jason, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh my gosh, thank you for having me. I'm really excited.
Well, let's start in 1968 there. We heard from Tommy Smith, John Carlos raising their fists. This is something these Olympic medalists had carefully planned to do ahead of stepping on that podium. What was their message? Remind us.
Their message was to speak out against social injustice and to sort of raise concerns about, you know, injustices that are happening to black communities and black people at the time. And it was obviously really powerful. And you noted that it caused ripples across the sporting universe. And it's because they took the opportunity to be able to do this at a time and in a place where these kind of messages usually aren't sent. There's a lot of discussion about how, you know, the Olympics usually likes to send messages about it being like a time of unity and where all nations are sort of one thing rather than a divided thing or things with separate, you know, sort of ideologies. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that they took this time to stand up and against the usual messages that are sent in the Olympics obviously caused that, those kinds of ripples. It was pretty interesting that way.
How has their image on the podium held up, you know, 50 years, half century later?
It's been really interesting, right? Because at the time it was, you know, pretty contentious in that, you know, people were either, you know, sort of taking an opportunity to say this is something that shouldn't happen or should happen, something that's important or not, as the case might be. But as things, as time goes on, these things tend to get sort of appropriated and kind of sort of folded into the, you know, sort of sporting universe. So I think it's common now for people to use the image without thinking about what exactly was being said at the time, you know, and how that might have parallels to what's going on today. So you'll see, you know, the image on shirts or, you know, in magazines and stuff without actually people thinking about what exactly they were saying about the time and the place, and even how, like, their message might be parallel with somebody like Colin Kaepernick. So people who would be fine talking about these two Olympic athletes and thinking what they did was right and good, but not thinking about, you know, how what they're doing might be similar to what Colin Kaepernick has been saying.
Of the 49ers taking a knee for the national anthem.
Yes, indeed.
What are some of the most common reasons people think that sports and politics should not mix, should not interfere with each other?
I think there's sort of a contemporary reason for that, and sort of maybe a deeper reason for that. So the more contemporary reason is that these sports leagues are kind of branding themselves that way, right? It's in their interest for them to sort of communicate that this is sort of apolitical, sort of, you know, colorblind meritocracy.
We're rising above this.
Exactly. And pretty much all the sports leagues do that. So when race is acknowledged, it's acknowledged in a way that it's something where we're you know, stepping beyond racism or something of the sort. And so the first answer is that's what the leagues are doing, and that's what they're encouraging themselves to do, that's a message that they're trying to send. But I think at a deeper level, it's easy to think about sports as sort of a meritocracy in and of itself, right? The best get to play, and, you know, that's the end of the story, right? And so I always try to encourage my students, or whenever I have conversations like this, for people to think about how sports has always been and always will be a reflection of culture, and therefore there is no sort of stepping outside of culture or politics. There is no space that's free from that, despite how it might
seem. Oh, they will always
seem.
Infuse each other, mm-hmm. You know, always be interlinked.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, a couple days from now, millions of people will be watching the Super Bowl. How do big sporting events connect people, capture people's attention, who may not even be huge football fans, but they will be looking for subtle clues of activism?
How people will be looking for subtle clues of activism? I think the first thing is that people are always taking major cultural events like this to be able to, you know, think about how it's reflecting our contemporary culture, right? And to, like, enact debates and that are currently happening. So no matter what, that's going to happen just because it's a big cultural event. But I think the Super Bowl in particular, since it has so many eyeballs on it, it's a good opportunity for people to particularly, like, sort of hone in, you know, things like the commercials. Which, you know, there's always a commercial or two that people are going to be upset about, that are going to be, you know, like, I don't agree with this for this or that reason. The halftime show that everybody's checking in on, you know, everyone's looking for things in there too. And I just think it's a good opportunity for people, like, to access it even if you're not interested in football.
We're talking with Jason Quito Lopez, who teaches media cultural studies at UW-Madison. We're looking at athletes taking a stance on social justice issues. How do you feel about athletes sharing their political views on and off the field or the court? Should they be allowed to express themselves or just focus on the sport? How do you disconnect the two? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Teresa now in Madison with thoughts on this. Hi, Teresa.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, I wanted to say that I think when our athletes are able to display their individuality, whether that's a political statement, a religious, you know, Tim Tebow praying, I think it's exactly the best of America on display, that we are about freedom and individuality with a collective goal. Look at what a lot of our athletic teams are about. It's about that goal of winning, but it brings all of the individuality, whether it's race, political views, religion, together. And I think it's exactly what's right about America. We should not be afraid of that.
Teresa, thanks for those thoughts. Teresa sees this freedom of speech and expression on display as, you know, as America not being persecuted.
Yeah, I think Teresa really is picking up on something important, which is that no matter what we're going to get in sports, like there's always going to be individualistic expression. And so I think a lot of the athletes end up getting criticized when they sort of cut against the normal kind of messages that we get in the sport. You know, so for instance, you know, you're like with Colin Kaepernick again with him kneeling, he's supposed to stand with his, you know, hand over his heart, and then when he takes a knee in order to communicate something else, all of a sudden that's supposed to be a deviation and supposed to be abnormal or something, right? And people sometimes get upset with that. But I like Teresa's idea that, you know, whether you decide to stand with your hand over your heart or whether you decide to kneel, you're still making a political expression no matter what, right? And that's an individual decision that people are making that sends a message regardless of what you decide to do.
Well, the former San Francisco 49ers quarterback, as you talk about Colin Kaepernick, brought attention to the issue of police brutality in 2016, kneeling in protest during the national anthem. And he opened up about this to reporters about his decision to protest. And this is from 2016.
There are a lot of things that are going on that are unjust. People aren't being held accountable for. And that's something that needs to change. That's something that, you know, this country stands for freedom, liberty, justice for all. And it's not happening for all right now.
What made Kaepernick's comments there, his actions, so controversial in the NFL?
Well, like I just said, I think it was the deviation from the norm. You know, these leagues are built around sending particular sets of messages that they've you know, taken to be a part of their brand, right? And so one is, you know, a support for a particular kind of support for the American military, right? Mm-hmm. And that gets expressed and gets tied to certain notions of patriotism. And so when somebody deviates from that, it's often taken to be anti those things, right? So even though he was speaking about something very specific and he's always been very clear about what he's been speaking out against, it was taken to be anti-American or anti-military just because it cut against the grain of how things usually go in that realm.
How did the NFL respond? How did fans respond?
Not well. The NFL sort of endured it for a season, and then he was sort of not hired by the NFL and still hasn't been hired. In fact, his old team, the Niners, are now playing in the Super Bowl, which, you know, he could be feasibly, like in another universe, the quarterback of that team. He alleged in a lawsuit that he was being blackballed. It was settled out of court. A lot of people still think that he was indeed sort of kicked out of the league because of this expression. The fans could also be really rough. So I will say, though, I think a lot of it's easy to go to the negative side of things, in that, you know, you'll see YouTube videos of people like burning his uniform in effigy, which is, you know, really horrible imagery. But a lot of people really supported him. You know, there was also a lot of like people who came to his side, a lot of famous musicians and actors came to his
side.
And
athletes as well.
And other athletes as well. Yeah. So people want to focus on Kaepernick, but, you know, there were other athletes both in the NFL and outside of the NFL. You know, I always take an opportunity to shout out Megan Rapinoe, you know, took a knee with him and in solidarity with him as well, you know.
We're at the intersection of sports and politics. What happens when athletes take up causes? Jason Quito Lopez is our guide. He teaches media cultural studies courses at UW-Madison. Do you plan on watching the Super Bowl? What are you most excited about? What are you most excited about? The commercials, the halftime, the game itself? What messages will you watch for from the athletes, from the ads? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. From hashtag take the knee to linked arms to a black gloved raised fist, we're exploring athletes' displays of unity and defiance on the field that reverberate through time. Should sports and politics mix? Why or why not? How do you feel about political protests and expression at sporting events? What will you be watching for on Super Bowl Sunday in terms of social messaging? We're at 800-642-1234. Jason Quito Lopez teaches media cultural studies at UW-Madison, and he stays with us. Jason, we have an email here from Paul in Eau Claire who asks, do athletes overestimate their own importance? Paul doesn't follow athletes or athletics, thinking that their opinion matters at all strikes Paul as kind of bizarre.
Yeah, I think that makes sense because, you know, at the end of the day, they're citizens, just like you and me and, you know, anybody you could walk on the street. And so, you know, they might be more or less educated about the things that they're speaking about, just like, you know, any other person. And but I think there's something that's on the one hand, kind of neat about that, right? That the fact that everyday people can be like brought into the spotlight and then therefore have the opportunity to be able to speak on things that we normally don't get to hear in, you know, mainstream media, right? Like the idea that Colin Kaepernick can take an issue that disproportionately affects, you know, a certain group of people and then raise it to light, uses fame and the opportunity to sort of raise this kind of thing to light, I think is actually kind of neat and interesting.
Carmen from Milwaukee called in to say that Colin Kaepernick was allowed his freedom of speech, but is still being punished for it. Let's turn to the Houston Rockets general manager, Daryl Morey, who caused controversy after tweeting in support of pro-democracy demonstrators in Hong Kong back in October. What kind of criticism did you see in those tweets?
Well, I think as somebody who studies sports in the way that I do, I think what was interesting, the thing that I ended up focusing on was his relationship to the NBA, right, and what that represented for the NBA itself and his relationship to the NBA. So the NBA is currently, you know, and all leagues actually are trying to be more international, right? They're trying to think beyond the boundaries of the United States. And the NBA in particular is trying to make inroads into China. And so this tweet from a general manager, he's a general manager for the Houston Rockets, this tweet from somebody who's in a position of power was a major threat to, you know, their business
ends. Off message for the NBA.
Exactly. And so this was a threat. But also, you know, he's also an influential figure, too. And so they were here we have another case, just like with Colin Kaepernick, where we have somebody going against how the league would prefer to brand themselves. So, in fact, I think I saw a report recently that it cost them, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, actually. They're trying to say, and we could, you know, doubt what, you know, we could talk about whether that's really true and whether this one tweet actually did that. But it's clear that there's the message out there that this was bad for business and bad for their brand.
Well, looking back at the Super Bowl coming up here this weekend, ex-NFL star Anquan Boldin will talk about the fatal police shooting of his cousin in a TV ad. And this ad has already been circulating. It's part of the NFL's Inspire Change initiative, tackling social issues such as police brutality.
I think far too long we've avoided the conversation. And I think by avoiding that conversation, we are where we are now. But I think anytime you bring a situation to light, you have the ability to deal with it.
Okay, so what is the significance of their featuring this retired NFL player, and what is the message?
So I'm always really interested in things like this. So in particular, I'm interested in athletes being able to speak out and sort of through their the leagues and sort of like how the leagues portray themselves. And so since the leagues are always trying to represent themselves as sort of pushing narratives that are kind of like live and real, you know, you actually get to know the athletes and you see their real personalities on display and that they enact these sort of unscripted events out on the field, both on and off the field, kind of like a soap opera, right? Like a real life soap opera. But with that comes, you know, them being able to use that opportunity to sort of speak out on things that they think are important to them, such as, you know, police violence or racism or something. But then when they do so, then the league has now this on the one hand, they have to sort of deal with it and they kind of turn it into an opportunity for themselves to kind of encompass it, right, and to kind of like swallow it up as well. And so
it's almost like they can't have both worlds in a way. They can't rein things in and control things, and yet they can also see the benefit of the expression itself.
Indeed, that's exactly right. And so these kind of media campaigns are their attempt to be on the one hand, right? The first hand that you're talking about, the control of it, right? To sort of get a hold of the message and adapt it to something that is controllable and something that's more on message. And so so this sort of Inspire Change, I believe it's called, is that right? Inspire
mm-hmm.
Change.
Yep.
It comes in in response to a lot of the athlete activism, like Colin Kaepernick and LeBron James and other NBA athletes wearing the I Can't Breathe shirt to memorialize Eric Gardner. They started these media campaigns called like Let's Listen Together and Voices that are all opportunities for them to be able to kind of get control of this. So like, well, the athletes are talking about social justice, so let's talk about social justice. But they don't talk about, you know, police brutality in the same way that the athletes were talking about it. They don't talk about racism in the same way that athletes were talking about it. They sort of, if you go and look at it, they kind of like bend it to talk about like community organizing and like it being a matter of dialogue between
run some filters on
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly.
Talking with Jason Quito Lopez, who teaches sports media courses at UW-Madison. We're looking at athlete protests, social justice issues through time. Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Mike now in Madison with thoughts on this. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Colin Kaepernick will forever be tied to this issue of the excessive police brutality. His image will be ingrained in everybody's mind, kneeling at the sidelines with his big hair, and it's kind of like a piece of art to see that image because gutturally it brings up emotions in people either for or against him. And I think even the NFL, by keeping him out of the league, has actually amplified his voice. And I think in the future, people will see that this issue, he will become an iconic figure, and that image will become so memorialized in people in this issue. And I think it's something that was necessary. Mm-hmm. And the only other big individual in sports I can think of is Lou Gehrig. The disease
uh-huh.
that
yeah.
took him, that is really tied to his name, and that again is another social cause that people fought to try to cure that disease.
Mike, thanks so much for those reflections, Jason.
I think there's a few things in there. First off, I kind of like the idea that maybe by blackballing him in that way, or allegedly blackballing him from the league, maybe they ended up amplifying his message in some way. I think that's interesting, right? Like, just because it's a corporation that might make bad decisions and therefore like end up doing things that it didn't intend to do. So I think Mike might be onto something there, perhaps. But I also think it's interesting that the idea of it being iconic, right? Because I think that there's a way in which that brings it back to where we started with the Tommy Smith
in 1968.
In 1968, right? Where like the idea is that these things tend to kind of get appropriated in ways, and the message tends to change. And so, could we, 30 years from now, look back on this protest and have like shirts, where like everybody's wearing shirts with Colin Kaepernick kneeling on the side net? I think that could certainly be the case.
We're short on time here, but the passing of Kobe Bryant. Hmm. Any images there that stick with you and the things that Kobe stood for?
I'm from LA, and I'm a Lakers fan, and so I've been kind of like keeping sort of track by text, like how people are taking the news, and it seems pretty rough. I've got a buddy who lives within a couple of blocks of the Staples Center, and he's just been kind of like keeping me up to date on like what people are doing, and so the expression. So like, it's interesting to see how that it's an interesting case of like sports bringing people together. But I, it's also interesting as a media scholar to think about, how people are covering the case too, with, he's an all-star, he's a father, there's the Colorado case too, where he was accused of rape. And so like watching how media people deal with that has also been really interesting as well.
Jason, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Jason Quito Lopez teaches sports media courses at UW-Madison. Just ahead, we look at the long-storied history of log cabins. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.